Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy.
So, it's an old mucker today, isn't it?
It is. And apparently, you might be in trouble.
I am in trouble. I am going to be in trouble. But first, before the whatever starts flying, it wasn't my fault.
So, what exactly happened?
When they did the remake of when the Power Station got back together in 1996, Bernard Edwards, unfortunately, sadly, died while they were making it. And so they had these dates booked. So I got asked to, and then John Taylor was going to do it, and then John didn't do it. And so I was kind of the third wheel. I got asked to play bass. But I said, yeah, I can do this Japanese tour, but I have to come from New York. And I did. And the problem was United Airlines. My plane was, I was going to get in at midday on the day of the show. My plane was 2 hours late leaving New York, and then had a mechanical problem in San Francisco and was stuck there for about 8 hours. And I didn't make the show.
Of course, we're talking about Andy Taylor, who's coming on and obviously played in Duran and the Power Station. But hang on, who played that show that night?
Here's the thing. Luke Morley, who was the second guitarist from Thunder, who they had to go and find a left-handed bass for.
Oh, no. And have you spoken to Andy since?
Well, we did the whole tour. I mean, I did the whole rest of the tour. It was fine after that.
Okay.
I wonder if we should even be giving this away now. I wonder if maybe we should...
I wanted your evidence within a closed environment. safe space. Before we introduce the story to Andy.
Yes.
I wrote a few things down here, Guy, and it's a kind of a quiz which listeners can sort of keep up with and shout at their devices about. Because Andy is our third
Durani.
Member of a band.
Yeah.
That we've had, but and we've never had that before. Now we've had two people from one band. So I wondered if you could begin the list.
Ah, well, hang on. Do we want our listeners to guess this or are you quizzing me?
Well, they don't have to guess it because they can just look it up, but they could shout at the device. But I'm sort of quizzing you. I'm wondering if you could recall these.
Yes. Tears for Fears.
Yes.
Tears for Fears.
Both Tears and Fears.
We haven't had four on yet.
At one point, no.
Deep Purple.
Deep Purple, of course. Glenn and the Cove.
The Cove.
Yeah. There's another Cove connection. Whitesnake.
Yeah, I'm trying to think who we've heard from Whitesnake, apart from me.
Bernie Marsden.
Oh, my God. Of course, Bernie Marsden, yes.
How easy we forget.
What do you mean, how easy we forget? We've done, like, over 160 of these.
I know. You're old.
It's like being in a spelling bee or something.
Okay, come on. There's got to be another one.
Spandau Ballet, because we've had you and Martin.
That's true. Yeah, I never thought of that.
Pink Floyd, because we've had Nick Mason twice.
At different ages. Sparks, of course, because we had both of them on.
Oh, that's true, yeah, but I wasn't looking for that.
Genesis.
Oh, yeah, of course, Mike and Steve.
Mike Rutherford and Steve Hackett. And there's another one on my list, final one. And it's Humble Pie.
Of course, because we've had Jerry Shirley and Peter Frampton.
There you go. I think that's it, but there might be more. So maybe our listeners can let us know if there are other dots, lines that can be drawn in this kind of Pete Frame family tree of raconteurs.
Yeah. You actually made a list.
I had nothing better to do.
You've out-frindled yourself, Gary.
I wrote it on my special ledger where I keep my bus tickets. This isn't very rock and roll, is it? This isn't very Duran Duran.
No, but it's very... No, it's not. But I was just thinking, this is very sort of Sunday afternoon, leisurely radio, isn't it?
Oh, let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
But it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found
Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I've been sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
That caused a big problem in the band, actually. I was having too much fun.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it, and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock Haunters Podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Hello.
Hey. Andy. Oh, mate. Good to see you.
Andy.
Hello.
Hello.
I am just testing my Pro Tools audio. 1, 2, 1, 2.
We're like a pro.
I got instructions.
Where are you?
I'm in the hotel. Just, what's it? You know, I can't even remember the name of it. The one near the BBC.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, so you're in London.
I'm starting my nuclear therapy on Thursday. So I've been having tests and scans and all kinds of, you know, far out science stuff.
Are you doing gene therapy or something? What is it?
I have got a wonky gene as well, which was another surprise. But what it is it's a nuclear medicine. So the stage I'm at, which was stage 4, like shit, basically, this therapy came into the UK only recently. It's very, very new. And essentially it's a nuclear medicine that it's put into your body and it detects the cancer on the outside of the cells. And it only hits cancer cells in your bones, which is mainly where it is with me, and zaps them. But if there's a healthy cell next to it, it doesn't touch it.
Wow. Oh, fantastic.
So it's not curative, but it can knock it out. And then it's got to start again. And
right.
From what was kind of, you know, I'll not even say the term they used to have on the thing, but I'm now going to be, like, back, I can get back to full fitness. I'll be fine for 5 years. And
oh man, because I saw you at the Wham documentary screening, and you were it was so nice to hear you say to me, you know, I'm off that bad list.
Yeah, I bumped into your brother as well, and you know, I think, and you know, when you've had that common experience of it could definitely go the wrong way, I'm always happy when I see people that made it. And you know, and I when you appreciate what everybody goes through when this sort of thing happens, family, and yeah, you know, it's a killer. Anyway, I know the band have been great, you know, so we've got a lot of stuff that we've been working on and under the radar. And the solo album I made.
I just wanted to...
I thought it was my last album. And so that's kind of where it changed.
I just wanted to... Because that the fact that you couldn't make... And congratulations for being a Rock and Roll Hall of Famer.
I mean, oh, you know, I've got here. I've got my little medal.
Oh, look.
That in itself's mental. I think that's... When we found out about that, and everyone's going, oh, it's a shoo-in, you'll get there, you've been. And I'm like, no. That's like saying your single's going to go in at number one, it goes in at number three, you know? And
well, I vote in it, Andy. So, you know, you're welcome, mate.
we had a lot of votes. So that was the other thing. You know, we had like so many public votes, and then you realize how fervent fan base still is. And I've spent some good years in Duran, but I qualified because I think I spent 12. I didn't know if there's a cutoff. Yeah, I think it's 12 years.
Wow.
Right? So, I mean there is and then you have to be a contract, it's all sorts of stuff. Anyway, the great thing about Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is we've got some allies there now. One was our ex-agent, and the other one was one of the chaps that used to run MTV in the 80s.
Obviously, you not being able to get there was a real tragedy for you, and the letter that you sent and Simon read out was, that was so powerful for everybody.
Well, you know, he wanted, offered to read the letter out. Initially, because it was only about 3 or 4 days before that I had to kind of, you know, have a word with myself. You know, who wants to be Mick Mars? God bless him. But, you know, if you're not on 11 at one of those events, and I was on about 5, couldn't really stand up and play guitar. Did, you know, I did everything I could, but then I spoke to Merck, who's been amazingly brilliant with everything.
Merck Mercuriadis.
I said, I hadn't told the guys. He said, just write a letter, you know, you write well, write a letter. So, and really that there just took me about 15 minutes to write. I just thought, okay, heart to paper, and you can't, you know, you can't miss anything out. And acknowledging what they've done, which has kept the thing going, you know, I'm the cat that got the cream. Simon read it and he just said, you know, I think actually they moved the show and put them at the front so he could do that. And I was just, it's quite weird. I was sitting at home, but Tracy and my daughter who were coming with me, they were in London waiting for me to get to London. I was sitting at home. I was just with my grandson, my daughter, and this new cat who ended up becoming my little comfort animal. Mm. And it was quite surreal. And then Merck kept sending me clippings from the show on his phone. And I'm like, thanks, mate. Right. I think I'm just going to watch Joe Rogan or something. But it was sort of surreal. But then, you know how intense those things can be. And there was the nominees dinner, something at the British Embassy, you know, the whole drinks parties, red carpets, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just
put your health first.
I couldn't genuinely be trusted yeah. by myself to get there. And they did everything, you know, Merck and Niall and the guys, they were just going to send a jet to Ibiza, whip me in, rehearse, and straight back out. And then I looked at the price and I said, we can make about 10 albums for that.
Yeah.
It was crazy, but everyone was incredibly supportive. And fans, God, they were, you know, because I'm not in the thick of it, not being in the band, so I'm not engaged, and I've been, you know, trying to keep myself alive. And the response from the fans and the kind of, it's love and just stuff that you, it's difficult to put into words. But then when I got, after that, I got a lot of very, very amazing people got in touch with me from all over the world. And there's a chap here called Sir Chris Evans who took a look at everything for me and said, no, he said, there's a lot more we can do for me. He did my genomics, and he's a genius. He's a biochemist, kind of like, you know, Elon Musk of cancer.
Wow.
He just knows everything. And he took a look at it really, really deeply and looked at the genomics and said, there's several ways we can help you. And the treatment I'm getting is probably the best.
That's amazing.
So because I didn't go, I got my life back.
Wow.
How weird.
That is amazing, isn't it? I mean, every cloud.
Oh, what a story.
Well, yeah. It's difficult, you know, because it was, well, you know what happened. I've never had chemotherapy. You know what happens with chemo if you're a guitar player. Your fingers can go. So I've always been able to use quite sophisticated drugs and stuff. But you get to a point where it's either this treatment or there's not really anything else that'll flush it out. And first thing, whenever I go and see an oncologist or a urologist, it's like, right, we got to protect your fingers. I'm like, great, that's a good place to start. Because it can actually destroy them.
And out of this, am I allowed to say that you and Simon have kind of bonded and you're working on some future material?
Oh, yeah. Well, so Simon and Yasmin came over to Ibiza and brought my award about 10 days after he got back. And Yaz and Tracy had known each other for ages, and they've always got on great. So they just came over with an got a great big magnum of fucking fantastic vintage Dom Perignon. And we just, you know, we've never crossed swords, me and Simon, ever, and always remained in touch. And I, you know, I was just shooting the shit with him, and then he was in my studio room in the house, and we're just sitting there listening to music and stuff. And he said, "I played your single on Sirius. I really like it." And I'm like, "Oh, wow, that's cool." And he's like, "You want to fire up some of it?" And so I fired up the studio, and I've got a set up. It's a really nice room to work in. And he's like, "I love it in here. Can I come over and work?" And I'm like, "Anytime, mate, you know." And so about 5-6 days later, he called me and said, "You know, we're going to do this album. It's kind of Halloween based, but looking back on material that was quite influential on everybody, and reworking some Duran tracks that are kind of dark, like Notebook." Anyway, he came over again with Josh, engineer, and I whacked down about 9 tracks in a couple of days. So
fantastic.
And the reworked versions of the Duran stuff sound really, really good. I was absolutely, you know, blown away with the way they'd augmented the chords. And then after 2 days, I'd got through 8 tracks, and I'm like,
wow,
riding a bike.
I saw him on Saturday night, actually, and he mentioned the album to me, and he was very excited about everything. You know, he's always excited, right? But he's,
yeah.
I'm so glad that's happening for you, because you deserve it right now.
You know, John was on FaceTime when we were jamming and stuff in LA, he's like, "No, leave the FaceTime on." And, you know, it was like, we've done it all virtually and hung out a bit and all that. And then when we finished on the, was it the Thursday night, me and Simon, he said, "Let's go out to dinner." I said, "Let's go down to the local." He says, "What'd they do?" I said, "Sausage, egg and chips." So we went and had sausage, egg and chips and a couple of pints. There's a couple of new tracks. There's one new track I played on. Fantastic. Really, really cool track. But there's something about a connection. And then what happened to us with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and there's a couple of other things that are more than in the pipeline. And that old bond just is very easy to kind of, you know, stick it back together.
Great.
And I think, you know, this sort of third wave of success that the band's having, you know, I'm really proud to be a part of it. It's quite nice being a part-time member.
Like being a grandparent rather than a parent.
I am both of those as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Andy, so talk about your album, yeah, right, which you did. Now, mate, where's this voice been all those years?
It's such a great vocal.
I mean, where's it been? I've played with you.
No.
I've written with you. Where was that voice? It's amazing.
Well, thank you. I think it's the first time when Hartwig at BMG, he actually, one day the phone goes and FaceTime, and Hartwig comes up. He said, "You know, I'd love to sign you to make an album." I'm like, what sort of album? He said, "Well, maybe Power Station, do a solo album. I don't care. I love your work, you know." And I mean, this was about 2016. And I'm like, "Great, just one thing. Will you just give me the money and leave me alone?" And he's like, "Absolutely, sure." And he did. And the company just let me find my voice. And so for the first time, I didn't just think about writing songs. I really thought about, you know, because I knew I had some bad stuff going on. And I thought, well, actually learning from Robert that you can go anywhere on a record.
Robert Palmer.
If you stretch it out, yeah, you find different parts of your voice. And then working, the people that I work with on the writing were just two really good friends of mine who were both great writers and get it.
Who were they?
Ricky Warwick, and a guy called Matthias Lindblom.
So Ricky was in, he's in Thin Lizzy, isn't he? Or
Thin Lizzy, Black Star Riders. I produced his The Almighty,
right?
You know,
right.
Soul Destruction, and that's where I met Ricky. But we've never written together. And I'm just one of those that, well, if I'm doing everything, producing, playing, singing, writing, you got to have someone who's solid to, you know, work with. Both lyrically and melodically, so you can really,
because the melodies on the album are so strong.
They help you.
The melodies on the album are really, really strong. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, first of all, I should say it's called "Man's a Wolf to Man," which you might have to explain in a minute. But I just think the there's a kind of early 70s. There's a lot of glam feel about it here and there. There's definitely Bowie. Wayne is really in your blood, isn't he, Andy?
Yeah.
It's well, you know, when I started writing it, Bowie and Prince died, and I remember when Bowie died, and me and Tracy were in a farmhouse in Ibiza just on our own, and she's a massive Bowie fan, and like me, you know, I think that's the one thing Duran would always agree on, is David Bowie. And you know, we just were like, and we just put Bowie on all night and celebrated it. And that, and you know, and I said to Tracy, I said, you know, the thing is, if you're still around to do it, and I'm still around to do it, because I'd just kind of been offered the record deal, I think, as well. It's like that, you know, when you get to a certain age, you've got to remember you're still around to do it. And some of the greatest influences in your life, you know, aren't. And it's quite, you know, when Bowie died, for me, it was like, and he was so young, and it's ingrained in me from Hunky Dory. You know, I mean, our generation were the Bowie kids, the ones that discovered his records and kind of took them apart.
That's why we did it.
Yeah. I don't think we could have formed Duran Duran without the Bowie influence, and certainly Paul Thompson's influence on Roger and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it all comes back to that. And I don't think anyone's really done it better than I can think of from that crop in the 70s, which was kind of, you know, that was our education, and it was a fucking fine education. Think about it. So Bowie runs deep, and not having to fit in anything, you know, there was no get this on Radio 2 or you got to do a viral TikTok or whatever the fuck. I just wanted to get back to making a record that actually felt meant something to me, as opposed to just writing something or producing something. I think the last record I did was the Ting Ting's third album, which actually was a lot of fun because they
were great, the Ting Ting's.
They're cut from the same cloth, you know, like eccentric British pop, and Jules is a bit of a genius, and Katie's a really cool singer. And they've just done another album. And, you know, we kind of swap each other's progress, and they've just done an album. It's got some of her classic vocal style that she's used, but it's very West Coast. It's very harmony based. It's a beautiful record. And they're like kind of like me. We just do it. That's what life is. You just do it, even if you don't release it. You know, you still do it.
Because you've been playing with Reef for quite a while. Because when I heard a few of those tracks from this album a while ago, and I thought it was the guy from Reef who was helping you out with the vocals as well on some of them.
So Gary, initially, before the pandemic and you know, the cancer take, Gary had sung about half the vocals. Anyway, after I started looking at the album again, I was sitting in the studio in Ibiza, and Tracy Riley comes in, and she's like, "Why aren't you singing all this album?" And I'm like, "That's a good question." I said, "Well, I probably had, you know, maybe being a little bit cautious." And Gary's such a wonderful singer, and I'd started working with Reef, so it was an easy thing anyway. She's like, "You should sing it. They're your songs, you know?" And I'm not working with Gary now, and a lot of things have changed. So I think there's three or four tracks that I redid the vocals on that Gary did. All but right. Man's a Wolf to Man, the Influential Blondes, I'd all of those I'd done the vocal for.
Great title, that, by the way, Influential Brilliant. Blondes.
Yeah. It's about the rise of fascism in the modern world. I'm not, it's, but you know, it's, and it's kind of written from distorted view of a film fashionista like Harvey Weinstein. There's a line in it, sign your name, silence is blue. Soon as you sign those contracts, your NDA shuts you up and then people control you. And all that Weinstein, Trump kind of thing all at the same time. It's all the same kind of, you know.
Well, so weren't you 100 days in or something, 100 days into Trump when you...
That's a track called Liberation, which came out as a single originally. Gary sings that. I mean, it's like you need to have the AC/DC brains to do it. And he blew it away. Ricky and I wrote it on the 100th day of Trump's presidency. And there's a line in it that says, 100 days of madness. Who's keeping score? And you know, when we were young, it was turbulent, but we were all dressing up and partying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right, and it was our answer to the crap was to Clubland was the escapism for me from northeastern nowhere. You know, that kind of vibe. I think what I discovered about finding your voice, and when I moved on, was the more you kind of open up about lyrics and are actually saying something that is relevant in the moment, it's a lot easier to express it. And the other thing is I did, I quit fucking myself up, but, right. You know, in my 40s, went and had a good old check. I said, take a look at my larynx, and the ENT guy did. And he said, it's in 100% good condition.
Andy, this album had two things going on, and you know, you had first maybe your cancer coming into your life, and lockdown. I mean, you know, and it's not good to have cancer and lockdown, because that must have been a trial in itself.
And you're in Ibiza, right?
Well, when we got stuck in Ibiza when the first lockdown came, which wasn't so bad to be quite honest, but it meant. You know, I wasn't on any chemo treatment or anything like that. I was on drugs, legal drugs. And so I could coordinate. I could get blood tests done in Spain, and then I could have. So it wasn't too complicated, but the hospital shut down and you weren't having face-to-face visits. And I know a lot of people, you know, got their treatment cancelled and they didn't make it. So... we had the Reef album in the bag. We had my album in the bag. And then I remember we were in the studio in London in Strong Room mixing. And then it started coming on TV about what was happening in China. And like the guys are like, think that'll affect us? I'm like, well, it's already in Italy. And, you know, it looks pretty bad. And within a week, I'm sitting holding two albums, a rotten cancer diagnosis. But I took enough equipment with me to Ibiza to kind of finish off the Reef album. And that kept me busy sort of through it. But in fact, actually, just having a place to write and, you know, a studio room just to play in and do music's sort of, it's probably been the most powerful tool in terms of, you know, the psychology of it all.
But you've been in Ibiza for a long time, hadn't you, Andy?
Off and on, yeah.
You had a place there.
Off and on. Well, when we got Duran back together, London wasn't really an option for us. And Ibiza used to be quieter then. Nothing happened till July. There was no fucking Leonardo DiCaprio's or any of that stuff. It was all those clubbers. I mean, we know who they are. This is, and that, you know, they all came out the 80s and 90s. And there was that period where now they shut the clubs at 6 a.m. But, you know, that late 90s, early noughties, where it was great fun. And there wasn't too much, there was no big kind of Ushuaias and Hard Rocks and that branded stuff. It was all fun was local.
But was it hard for you to sort of stay clean and healthy? Living there, was the temptations always on your doorstep?
Like anywhere, you know. I think London's a lot more dangerous on many, many levels. But the when we were in our early 40s, we had a great time. I mean, you know, I'd go down with Andy and Mike and all that crew, Manumission, and it was a hoot. But actually, by that point, I wasn't really, you know, when you get into your 40s, it's not something that really you can really wear well. And I eventually kind of slowed down on clubs, really about 2006, 2007. I couldn't keep up with it. And I keep going out and seeing my kids. So that's like, okay, Dad.
Right.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare, AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out.
Before we came on, Guy was telling me a story about how he missed him.
I've been warned by Julian and his PR. I was going to get a roast.
and Julian's and his PR.
So, have you got a left-hand base?
I fucking should have, because I bought one, it looks like.
it's somewhere in a sock.
Did they take it out of your wages then, Guy, when they bought the left-hand base?
Yeah, but that's the thing. When I got home from the tour, my wage, there was $1,500 deducted for rental of a left-hand base. And I spoke to Harper, Robert's manager. Yeah. I went, well, where is it? $1,500. I've bought it, mate.
He's not the right person to speak to, is he?
About much. No.
So there we are, and I don't even think Harper was there.
No, he wasn't. I don't think.
No, in fact, I think at the time him and Robert were having a bit of a set too.
Yeah. Oh no, it was the other guy. It was the partner. It was the partner.
Yeah. Actually, I think it was Harper's son that was there, looking after Robert. I can't remember who was with us.
Youngblood. Donnie Wynn used to call him Youngblood.
They used to call him Youngblood. And he used to have a little thing, write everything down, because he could never remember anything.
Who was Harper?
David Harper. He was Robert Palmer's manager. Yeah.
And, I get a call. It's like, oh, there's a delay on Guy's flight. And I'm like, first thing I said was, I warned you about this. Oh, fuck no, it's not enough. You know?
No, it was a bit more than that. I was meant to be getting at midday.
Anyway, Everyone's looking like, I said, all sheepish and stuff. And I'm like, and I know that the plane was delayed and stuff. And I said, okay, well, we're going to lose most of tour profit if we lose one show. So Sunday afternoon, and
Luke Morley, this is from Thunder, who was the second guitarist.
Now, Luke was playing second guitar, right? And it was just me, Luke, Tony, and the bass player dude. He was a
me
before
John
you.
Taylor, wasn't it? No,
it was Manny.
Manny, yeah.
Yeah, right. Because he couldn't come. So we were only going to be two guitars, bass and drums, and there was no brass or anything. So when we stripped it down, and Luke, for some reason, you know, he is so competent as a musician. We sat down and he's like, yeah, I got them all. And I think we had a few before we went on, and it was fine.
Yeah, there you go.
The thing is, because me and Luke were doing all the harmonies with Robert and stuff, then we did some like it hot as a three piece. No keyboards, but
we had no keys.
Mm.
But
we miraculously found a left-hand bass. I think it was in a Sarka, and
that's for $1,500.
Yeah, and I also remember straight after the gig, I said to Luke, "You know, we need a drink," and they're like, "You'll never find a bar open in a Sarka at midnight," but we did.
Well, funny thing is, when I arrived, Andy, I went to get my key, and there was a note from Mary Ambrose, Robert's partner. Yeah. Right, she just went, "Go to bed, don't go to the bar. They will kill you."
Which you did go to bed. You took her advice.
It was a fun tour, though. Do you know what, actually? Shall I say, there's a very sweet little sidebar Robert memory.
Yeah,
which is one of the days we had in Tokyo, Robert says, "Oh, Guy, do you want to go shopping?" I'm like, "Yeah, shopping with Robert Palmer in Tokyo, yeah." And of course, you're thinking, you know, it's going to be one of those fabulous malls, or it's, you know, is Yoji Yamamoto's going to open the shop up? But no, and this was so Robert, Yorkshire Robert. He had a folder, and in it, he had a card on which he'd stuck all these bits of paper, which he'd cut out of magazines, which were the names and addresses of specialist shops. Like, there was a model gun shop. There was a shop that did barometers or something. All this weird stuff. And some of it was like miles out of Tokyo. And it was just the weirdest thing to do in Tokyo. And it was just so charming.
Yeah, that was the last time I saw Robert. But when Duran played there, I think in 2003, because I always hung out with him a bit, and you know,
you wrote about it very sweetly in your book about the last time you saw him.
I remember that, and we were playing at the Budokan, and I get this message from him. He's like, "Yeah, I'm playing in a club up the road, midnight. You want to come?" And I'm like, "Well, you finish like 8 o'clock at the Budokan," so I'm like, "Get the gear up the road." So tuck some stuff up. And then there he was, this packed club. He's like, "I've got a Japanese band, you know." I'm like, "Yeah, yeah, yeah." So he did a few songs. I came on. But what I noticed was the bottle of whiskey hadn't been opened. And I said to him, "Are we going to have a little shifty before we go on?" He says, "No, I can't anymore." I was like, "Oh, wow." And I noticed he kind of calmed down. But then I think I didn't leave until 10 a.m. the next morning.
Well, before the show, that was always his thing. Because I remember when I first met him, which was back in 83 on a tour, and because the other thing, because Robert was a very heavy smoker.
Oof, Dunhill.
Right, Dunhills. But he would stop when he went on tour. But what he would do is he would always light everyone else's cigarettes for them. Do you remember, if everyone was having a cigarette, "Oh, let me light that for you. Oh, can I light that for you?" So he was probably smoking about 20, and it was just really weird and slightly annoying.
I always, you know, if you ever needed a tab, just ask Robert.
He
always,
like Clark Gable and Lauren McCall handing you the cigarette.
Yes.
But, so I saw him like, you know, not before show, can't do it now, slowed down a bit, all that. And then... We had a fun weekend because we were doing a couple of nights at the Budokan. We had a bit of a late night. Fortunately, someone got me home, and then, you know, got like a 6 o'clock show. And then he came down the show, And we went down the hotel we were in. I think it was the Hyatt Roppongi then, which was like super cool. And there was about 30 of us. He hadn't seen John for years. And we just had this, it was actually our last supper. And it's quite ironic that we sort of spent this rock and roll weekend together. He came to see us. I got up and played with him. We did the old long dinner, you know, get stuck into the cellar. And him and John, you know, hadn't really spoken and that. And then a few weeks later, I came off tour and I was sitting by the pool in Ibiza. I get this call. He's sitting down. I'm like, I'm fucking lying down. What's going on, Robert? I'm like, he's 52.
Wow. Yeah.
And that really, again, you know, because you're like, that's sort of my lifestyle. I sort of do the same thing, maybe not in the same quantity, but, you know, and when you're with Robert, you really get carried up in it. And
Palmered. We used to call it Palmered. How'd you? I got Palmered.
Yeah. Oh, I met him. I think it was in. It was a squat or a kind of hippie kind of hanging out house in Notting Hill. I think it was either Steve Strange's or Boy George's.
Yeah, I think that was Steve.
He was mates with Steve Strange. Yeah. I know that.
So it probably was Steve's. And I remember me and John, I think we were recording Rio, and you know John lived at the Embassy Club, and we went back to Steve's and Robert was lying on the bed off his nut on acid doing the die and fly. And laughing his head off. Anyway, that was another artist we all had this kind of interest in. And, you know, because of his vocal and his style, I think, was, you know, there's very few people that could carry that off so effortlessly. And his range and his... And some of the risks he took with production.
And this is, I think, where you get to give yourself a bit of a pat on the back, because the Power Station is kind of the thing that made everything possible for him, you know, that turned it around and got
him.
Yeah. Because Addicted to Love wasn't who he was, but he needed that to get him out. And it was a Power Station that got him there. Got him Bernard, you know.
Well, the funny thing is, he had Addicted to Love when we were recording. He had the song.
Right.
Just kept it in his back pocket, which, you know, I admire, to be quite honest. But that, yeah, the whole, the drum sound thing and Tony and, you know.
And a big, big thank you from me for my first proper fucking payday ever.
Well, that's where we
ever.
Met.
I had a song on it. I mean, amazing.
Go to Zero. It's great. Yeah. Really cool song. We're, you know, Tony had that. Bonham in him, and as I got to know Tony when he was on the Bowie tour, he's like, he really wanted to do something else, and I'm like, I'd just love to have played with him. Anyway, it kind of started, and I, when he told me about his Bonham thing, and I watched him play, and like Bernard and Niall were like, yeah, we try to be a rock band, but no one wanted a black rock band. Obviously inspired by the Let's Dance record and some of the drum sounds on that, but we did it at Maison Rouge, big drums. And that just said, like, once Tony had done that, and then Bernard had sat in and then got John into the groove, and, you know, playing with them was kind of something that you had to
work. And Jason Cassaro deserves a shout as well.
Jason would just go, and if it sounded good, he didn't care what was flashing. Mm-hmm. And he was very Machiavellian, but also... you know, those musical engineers, they're the ones that have got that, you know, that musicality in them, and they can balance stuff. And he was we relied a lot on Jason. But Bernard was, you know, I always regarded Bernard as something, you know, how can you get near to that? Can you get in a place where,
yeah.
And like, I remember sitting one day and I'm saying, no, do it like this, Bernard, play that. And I'm thinking,
yeah, can you tell Bernard Edwards?
But he was absolutely.
I mean, you
master.
Mentioned Bowie earlier about how we were all Bowie, but the other people we also were that, you know, it was Chic, you know, that
with the funk shit, yeah. And I mean, I was a big Northern Soul fan up in Newcastle, but Chic was another element. The production groove, the playing, and the songs, that all of the Duranga, particularly John, first time I met John, me and John and Rog jammed, and John just had this kind of Bernard Edwards that, mm-hmm. you know, I can crang a bit like Angus, and he could groove a bit like Bernard, and we were like on the same page, and I'm like, oh yeah, I can do that chuck and that, and it, you know, we discovered each other by jamming one day in an audition. But
back then, it must be said, you were kind of really writing a book on with like, especially on those, a lot of those early hits, man, with that kind of, it wasn't disco, it wasn't rock, it was as you'd found
this
thing.
I tell you what else Andy had, which was almost, his guitar parts were almost like brass parts at times, you know, they were staccato and I mean, but the grit that you were putting in, the smoothness of the chic, you know, rhythm section made it unique.
I remember when I met the guys, they were fans of punk and guitar bands. And so that element of sound, I mean, that was the thing that was very, you know, cool about Nick. He had all sorts of Roland stuff going on, but it didn't give it the edge. And that was one of the things with the label was, you know, a band who's got a quite, if you break those Duran tracks down, they sound like house tracks with 808s going and little sequences and stuff. Mm. And then you put the band on top and it sounds like Duran Duran. So Nick had this that little core of an idea, and it really was always quite a hybrid. And the way, you know, when he's running a sequencer, right? So you've got a, you know, you've really got to chop the guitar a little bit, like reflex and stuff. And then Rod used to say, you know, you got this kind of slashing way of playing. And for me, that was actually, it's the rhythm aspect of it as much as.
No, I took a lot off of you, Andy, later on in the 80s, you know, because I think you established a certain type of playing guitar that was in the same way that Andy Summers also established a certain 80s sound. I think you also should get the award for that as well.
No, absolutely. Also, because you had some dirt in your sound, whereas everyone else was going clean.
I used JCM 800 since I could afford them, and never really changed. I used a Marcio pickup, so I never ever changed that. You know, from being a kid, and you know when you can learn to. Because when I played in the clubs, you learn a lot of different techniques.
Who were your heroes at the time? Who was your guitar playing heroes?
Well, it was. I mean, initially. I was a huge Mick Ronson fan, Gary Moore, you know, all of the Lizzy stuff, Robin Trower, Kossoff. My immediate neighbor across the road from me was a guy called Dave Black, an absolutely phenomenal Les Paul kind of blues rock player. And he could also play quite a bit of jazz. Anyway, Dave, he was a few years older than me, and he was one of those guys in the Northeast that was considered to be probably the best guitarist, one of the best guitarists I've ever known. Anyway, one day when I was about 13, I knocked on his door. I'm like, Mr. Black, you know, holding up a pound coin or something, you know, could you give me a few lessons and sort of help me get on? And he was like, absolutely, you know, when he worked professionally in the clubs and that, he said, anytime after school during the day, I'm not working, I just work at weekends. So this guy showed me all the cool shortcut scales. He showed me all those bloody Stevie Wonder chords, 13s, 11s, major 7s, you know, and how they were used melodically against how we would use kind of a more white European way of chord structure. But he was a phenomenal lead guitar player. So every time I sat in front of him, he'd do something and I'd be straight back home in 4 hours trying to figure it out. Anyway, when the Spiders from Mars all broke up, he took Mick Ronson's place with Mick Woodmansey and Trevor Bolden.
Oh, wow.
And that was, when that happened, I saw them once turn up at my house. And when that happened, I was about 13 or 14. And it was just there across the road from me, the fucking Spiders from Mars on my street. And that made me think anything's possible.
He wasn't in U-Boat, was he? He didn't play.
No, he had a band called Goldie, which they had a few Top of the Pops hits, and then he just stayed up north.
Oh, I remember them.
Yeah. So, and he wrote as well. So he gave me a kind of quick education about PRS when I was a kid, and don't let them take half of it from you. And
what were you playing in the clubs? What was?
Oh, well, you're talking about 1976, 77 to 1980. So all that period, Blondie, lots of Blondie. Everything. There was, you know, Cool for Cats.
Squeeze, yeah.
And just, but I also used to do the military bases in Germany and Italy, where the 6 45-minute sets per night.
Well, wasn't that more of a soul thing, though?
No.
It
was a 300-song repertoire.
So who were the other guys in the band?
They were just local, the guys from Newcastle we got a deal, actually, when I was sort of 16 or 17 for A&M, and we were called the Gigolos, but they changed it to Motorway. But then I fell out with a singer, which probably was a good thing because, you know, I ended up saying, you know, I couldn't really do much more in Newcastle, and I answered that Melody Maker advert. But I had I'd done quite a lot of demos before I joined Duran, loads of gigs, and that, you know, when you just learn to construct music and you get used to arranging and getting things down, and then eventually when it's ingrained in you, that's what helps you write. You know, that when you get to it and get to a chorus, you think, shit, I've hit that chorus at 1 minute and I didn't even realize it.
Perfect.
You know, that song thing where you'd learn so many songs and styles. I mean, I was playing in the officer's mess at Ramstein, Maine, that great big nuclear air base. And it was like, and you're dead quiet. And but the food was great.
Did you went on before the puppets, I take it.
I tell you, they were experiences because they were all short, those Vietnam guys, and they wanted to get out. Your officer's mess was one thing, but when you played for the GIs, free bird! Right? When I was a kid, playing the solo in Freebird was the standard. And then along come Eddie Van Halen. Right? But until then, play the solo in Freebird.
Yeah, yes.
you would certainly get the GI.
Because it was obviously Nick and John's band initially.
Yeah.
Did you always feel slightly that it wasn't your band? Or did you suddenly then it was all equal?
When I first obviously went down there and kind of looked at how they got it together and put it together, and you know, just like you, you know, with Steve and Paul and Mike were integral. They really were part of the whole thing. And I think
this is the Barrows, right?
Yeah. And when they were looking, you know, when they were looking for a guitarist and singer, because when I got down, there was no singer, they lied. They said he was on holiday, but there was no singer. But it was a vibe. It was just a thing that sort of happened. But I think there wasn't really a lot of songs, there were some good ideas. So when Simon joined, I think the first thing we wrote was Sound of Thunder. He had some lyrics, and I always loved doing key changes for choruses and things. So I just started applying that kind of arrangement knowledge to all these ideas. Nick had sequences going and stuff, which I'd never seen. And I'm like, let's get, you know, and programming the notes and finding this way to make it work. It was really interesting. And then we wrote Planet Earth, and that was our first single. And as soon as the ideas, I think there was an idea called To the Shore on the first album. There was a chorus of Girls on Film. But once we got into Planet Earth, nailed Girls on Film, wrote Nightboat, which all kind of start with guitar and stuff. Then essentially it's your work that gives you your pride of place. But I discovered that this band called Duran Duran, Roger just joined, and there was just something that told me instinctively, after being in loads of bands and trying this and trying that, that this had something about it that was, you couldn't really put it in
words.
Because
you could have been an old cynic, couldn't you? And sort of, you know, a Noel who knew all his chops and Midnight of the Oasis and all of that, you know.
I left them behind in Newcastle because, no, you know, it's all right knowing it, but you got to take it somewhere. And also, I walked into the Rum Runner. And there was nowhere like that in Newcastle.
I did that once.
And I was just like, wow. And so, you know, you've got your kindred freaks. You meet your own kind of, and they come from the same sort of music, you know, the attitude. But Nick was the DJ in the Rum Runner on the Bowie Roxy nights. And he was fucking great at it. And he used to fill the floor. You know, I mean, I'm the passenger and you know, that era of Bowie. Yeah. Not the early.
Now, we had the same down in London
and Berlin.
Yeah, Heroes era, and Nick had this that sort of new wave late 70s, and he had a great way of putting it together, and that kind of defined the audience what his DJing was. Nick, now, if he started the band, he'd be hugely paid DJ. He was really, really good.
And I was going to say, has he kept it up? Has he kept it up? Did he?
No. He just. it wasn't worth any money at the time. Now, I mean, I'm sure he could still do it. He doesn't need to. But that was one of the things that when you know the band, one of the originators of the band was a DJ who had a sense of what making that party happen. Just like what's happened, you know, with house music.
He knew how to do the set list.
And so, you know, everyone used to go there. That was cool. I met my wife there. You know, the Barrows owned the club. Michael sold his house to support us. He did some really, really, you know, incredible things. But that club was like... The first two albums are basically Hungry Like the Wolf wasn't written there, but half of Rio and the first album were written in the club on one of the side rooms that we rehearsed in. And then we just go in the club. And that's when the trouble began. It was all Pete Townsend's fault.
What happened?
After a Bruce Springsteen gig. Well, there was a kitchen. And occasionally, I used to be the chef to earn a bit of money before we had a deal. And we went to see Bruce Springsteen at the NEC, and we got some nice side of the stage, a couple of us and that, and Pete Townsend was there. And this is the end of 1980.
Oh, that's when Pete was on his big bender, wasn't he? When he was just
I saw him down at the Club for Heroes in London.
Like everybody.
I
see him everywhere, yeah.
Made it down to the Rum Runner, comes into my kitchen, and... So he starts, you know, doing what he did. Anyway, he decides to straighten up. And then he writes this open letter to the Sun about our behavior.
What?
And I'm like, you were fucking racking them out like you wouldn't believe. Probably can't. You know, but such a hypocrite. And then I bumped into him in Sheridan Studios and I had a can of Foster's. I think we were filming Wild Boy. He said, you still drinking? And I'm like, well, you taught everyone. You know, it really weird, but he was mad for it, and so, you know, the Rum Runner was on one of those canals in Peaky Blinders.
All right, well, I was to say, because what is it now? Is it
Now it's the Hyatt Hotel.
Oh, okay.
It got knocked down, but it had the rum barrels in, and it was on the canals where they used to run that's why it's called a Rum Runner. Used to be a boxing gym, and It was always a trendy club, and it was always owned by the Barrows. They're three generations deep. So we had a lot of, you know, we were well looked after in Birmingham. I remember that, really well looked after.
Did you, after, you know, because obviously what happened to you, you know, well documented, fantastic, you know, smashing it all over America and becoming such superstars. When you left the band, before the Notorious album, was there a sense of like, I've got to achieve what I did with Duran, or did you try and belittle Duran in your mind and see that just as a stepping stone to something else? I mean, how did you carry that?
So the great myth is that John and I started Power Station because we wanted a stretch out. In actual fact, there was a certain singer went sailing for a year.
Oh, yeah, he got upside down in his boat, didn't he?
Right, for a year. And that's quite a long time.
Well, especially when you're young, you remember how time is.
Yeah.
I mean, years, forever then.
I'm from a, you know, all of my family, I'm the first generation that's not a Navy man or an inshore fisherman or a lifeboat man. All my family are seamen. And it goes back generations, grandfather, great-great-great-grandfather. They're all lifeboatmen. So, you know, I was brought up not to mess about on the sea. And you need a lot of skill. My grandfather would never let me get in his cobalt. He died when I was about 7. But when I was a lad, he wouldn't let me get in his inshore fit small cobalt because it's quite dangerous. So then they bought a boat, had one race, and the keel fell off. John and I think we were in Richmond, Virginia. It was somewhere down that way. And I was literally getting ready for sound check, sitting on the end of the bed, having a bowl of soup, watching the telly. And it came on the news, the upside down boat. And it was quite, you know, I think it was a lot more serious, you know, in terms of what danger he was in. And then we had to go and get on stage. And in those days, I don't even think we had a brick phone in those days. It was, you know, literally communicating was difficult. Anyway, they got him out. And then they went off and did the round the world sailing thing. And so, you know, that period that had been created and that, Trevor Horn said it to me once. He said, it's great until you get the third album. And guys like you go off shopping, buy houses, boats, and making a record is like a nightmare. And it did get to the point where, you know, the effect it was having on us, not just the, you know, the consumption, but we did go hard at it in America, very hard at it. And it took its toll. And I remember after the Power Station tour, it was actually John and I were like, I was trying to get it on the level, you know, I just had a son. And Power Station had done so well, it kind of cleared up in my mind that, you know, Duran wasn't a fluke, because the pop business, as you know, can be manipulated quite heavily in certain areas. And it wasn't just that one thing, and you were bound to that. And I suppose that's what you said earlier, where, you know, I never fully felt like, you know, I'm a Geordie, I like football and beer, and I wear jeans. Nick can't stand any of that. So we were perfect for, you know, to find those idiosyncratic moments.
Which is probably why you were also so successful, because, you know, there was an appeal to different kinds of personalities within the band.
We all, you know, Simon had a lot of drama training, and he did TV adverts when he was a kid for like Purse and stuff, or Weetabix. And I was digging fags and booze and...
drink beer, you know, smoke tubs.
Yeah, and doing a milk round and sneaking in Newcastle City Hall. You know, and me and my mates became experts at how to get in anyway at the age of 13 with huge platforms. Yeah. So, you know, I had that kind of...
So what you're saying, Andy, was there was a sense that when you'd been successful in one band and now you'd been successful in another band, you had something amazing to offer.
Well, I did feel that both bands, you know, I'd given them the impetus, the momentum to start to work. And when I found that I getting it to work with Tony and Bernard was actually an ambition to try to get up there. And it wasn't playing with them at first was like, because you know, when you're just playing, Rog is so precise and tight sequences, and he's absolutely brilliant at it. And so you're just locked in. But then when you play with those guys without a click, and then I'm watching Bernard, how he conducted Tony, and he played Tony hit a cymbal and that. And then just getting into it with them. And then we cut Get It On, the cover of it. You know, I came up with that, the drum beat with Tony. He come up, he was like pea soup backwards, and I'm going, what's that? And he's like, I don't know. I just, you know, and I'm like, play again. And then Nard picked up that bass line, and I'm here and get it on, like, fuck. And the power in it. So then you can play as hard and as tough and, you know, you can really crank the middle up but the rhythmic aspect of it, that was where the learning curve really was kind of steep and brilliant. Because when you learn to play in that feel, and they, you know, they're all of such a level, you know, how Tony pushes his kick, snares back, and he has that thing of pushing his kick in. And it's a, when you look at it, it's, you don't hear it. I mean, I think he does it on like a Virgin really well. And you just get used to his lit. And then when ever look,
stick it to a brap. That was that fill he always had. Stick it to a brap.
That's brap, brap. Yeah. Stick it to a brap. But when you look at him playing, you'd be like, and he'd be pulling faces, and he was always happy to do it. And then he'd come up stage with man like shit about everybody. But it, when he was playing drums, he was phenomenal. So that was my, I suppose, you know, when you try and have those markers, those achievements, not the hits, the records, and the numbers, but the progress you make is as a musician. And the way that they accepted us and were just as interested in our way as we were as fascinated by theirs.
But that's the thing, you come out of all this and then you go on and then you're producing. So it's like you're still moving up.
Well, I got a call from Rod's management. It's like, and I'm like, I think I was making my first solo album, but that was kind of... Well, you know, you can't really say no when they throw that much at you. Really, the first solo album I made was not planned. It was offered. I didn't necessarily have in mind to have a solo career. And then when Rod's management rang me up and said, you know, you want to come down, sort of talk, we're working with Rod. I knew Rod and Randy. I didn't know Arnold too well. Anyway, I got chatting with Rod and just what he wanted to do. And he's like, what are those two like? I said, who? He said, Power Station blokes. I said, what, Bernard and Tony? I said, you'll shit your pants, mate, when you hear them play. He's like, can you get them down? And I'm like, you're going to have to pay them. They ain't cheap. Tony came down initially. And then I asked Bernard if he'd come in and co-produce with me because I was only 26 and Rod was 40. And Bernard, such an expert at doing vocals, you know, he had such experience, you know, Luther Vandross, used to be a backing singer, yes. Diana Ross. I mean, Robert, he had a great way of keeping singing vocals contained and getting it done.
What was the album called that you were working on?
The first Rod Stewart album was called Out of Order. And we had four big hits on it in America. So changed the band really and brought in Tony Bernard, Michael Landau, the session guitarist, played guitar. And then this dude called Smithy, who was from, yeah, this pink Cadillac, and he played organ like one of Rod's guys. And David Lindley came in and did a bit, which was fascinating.
Wow.
And then the next time, I got Dave Palmer to come in.
Ah,
yeah.
And David's still there.
And he's been there ever since, yeah.
ABC's
drummer.
He's been there ever since. And I knew Dave was perfect for Rod because, you know, David can play anything, but he can also swing so beautifully.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been fully compensated from Mr. Stewart. I've even seen the wallet. It's fucking huge.
How was it? Did you go on tour with him?
No, I nearly did, but then I just made this conscious decision not to be a sideman because I, you know, like me and Rod would argue, I didn't, you know, in 1985, he had no standing over us. You know what I mean? He couldn't. He was asking me to make records with him.
Well, yeah, you're producing him,
and sometimes like I'm like, fucking, I'm going to walk out of the room for 5 minutes, kind of thing, and. You know, someone, when they've made that many great records, they're never wrong. But I didn't want to then be in a position where when you're in the studio producing, writing, playing guitar, doing takes, you know, keeping it moving, and you've got all these great guys working with you, and you just charge. You get on the road, it's not that disappears. Mm. It's not your show.
Yeah.
And I started putting that band Thunder together with Luke Morley and Danny Bowes, and got them signed to EMI. So I was kind of doing what, moving into production. I had two kids by then, and I'd done about 10 years of it. I was nearly 30 and I was fucking knackered.
But did you, you know, when you got back with Duran, and I remember that being really inspiring. I came to those shows in the early 2000s, the one at Wembley, when you all walked out on stage at the beginning and stood in a line.
Which
quite a clever vibe, right? Because it was just the confrontational thing, but also all of you as individuals being as important as each other. I thought that was great. But I remember sitting watching that show thinking, fuck, I've got to get my band back together. But it took another 5 years before I convinced everybody. But it was such an inspiration. But did it become tricky soon for you to be on the road with them?
Well, I can't do band rules anymore. I can't do. And I discovered that second time round, that band rules can't trump life rules, family, kids. You know, there's only so much you can give up. And so it's like click of the finger, you got to be here. You're like in your mid-40s. And it's like, hold on. It's just impossible for me to live within band rules. Mm-hmm. Now, part-time, I'm great at. So I'm sort of part-time and doing stuff with Duran and a lot of stuff that we've been working on. But, you know, and I just had to come to terms with that I did start very young. You know, I was on the road full-time from the age of 16. And by the time I got 40, putting the band first, because that's everything. It's drop everything. Got to be there. It's every night. You know, the medicals for insurance.
Compromise.
The shin splits and all the shit. And you just got to have a word with yourself. But I also didn't really want to write songs with Justin Timberlake. And that's no offense to him whatsoever. But I always regarded the five of us as having enough talent, enough depth, if we dug deep enough to do it. And I still wanted to go that way, and the other guys wanted to go the other way, really. Mm-hmm. And after doing so much work with so many great people, you know, and particularly working with Robert several times and hanging out with him, just, you know, the vibe we had, we were good friends. And you know how limited that was, Guy. how many people he hung out with or worked, you know, he was very, very close. And, you know, you've got all these other places where you can kind of, you know, lay your hat or your axe or whatever. I'd still take making a brilliant album over making a shit one and making money.
Well, this is a good album. This is a really good, really good album. I mean, just the textures, the layers on there of, you know, this, I can hear that the arrangements, you know, talk about, you know, now you've told us about your, you know, all that stuff you did as a kid and all those, you know, earning your dues, you know, those 10,000 hours that you did. That's all here in this record.
Your whole toolkit is out.
I'm absolutely blown away, you know, because I know you two and you're both fucking good at what you do. That's really nice for you to say. I mean, really, really, you know, we've come a long way from the 80s. But I remember because I wasn't there when you cut Go to Zero. I didn't even know there was a previous demo until recently. But John, and I think Tracy was quite pregnant, and I think Andrew, our first, was due, and I wasn't in New York. He came over to see me with a cassette of that track with a vocal on and the groove and stuff.
We'd played everything. Yeah,
yeah, but there was no guitar on, and I'm like, and as soon as that I just had to kind of actually, I think I'm pretty sure. When I went in to do the guitar on that, Jeff Beck was doing day sessions with Jason and we were doing nights. I just plugged into Jeff Beck's rig.
Yeah.
Oh, do you know? Do you know there's a story about that? Well, no, because there was actually a lyric change to get your name in it, because on the original, because it was all written, it was written as a joke, right? The story of the song is, if we've got time, is Robert had one of those new, what was then new, Sony two-track recorders, the Sony F1, and it had all these new commands on it, which we'd never seen before, like swing search and go to zero. And my joke was, it was late at night in the Bahamas, you know that scene.
Yes.
And I said, why don't we write a song called Go to Zero and put it out under the name Swing Search, the idea of this band who can't find their swing. And so we were just joking around with this stuff. And then the only thing we could think to rhyme at the end of this one line was Adrian Belew. And he said, oh, I did some demos with Adrian Belew. I've got a solo of his. So he just went, Adrian Belew, go to zero. And he just put in this Adrian Belew solo from an old demo of his. And then he got to the studio. I said, well, obviously you can't have Adrian Belew. It's got to be Andy. And so he just rewrote it as Andy Taylor-oo, go to zero. And there you are.
Oh, yes. Good story. I'd love to think that you're going to be able to get back on stage.
Definitely. I am... Top of the agenda for this treatment is that it will allow me to get back on stage, get stage fit, get my muscle strength back. So probably, within a couple of months after a few cycles of treatment, by the end of August, I'll be in pretty good shape.
Man, stay in touch, would you?
That's brilliant, Andy.
I will.
That's really good great to hear. Really good to see you. And please send my very best to Tracy.
I think she's just over there. I know that you bumped into her on a flight once.
On a flight, yeah. And in fact, she'd been to my show the night before.
Oh, right.
She's been to my comedy show.
Oh, your comedy show.
Yeah, but I did a stand-up thing for it.
Oh, yeah. You still do that?
Nah.
No, he's too busy playing with us, doing Nick Mason's show.
Yes. No, I've been following. It's amazing. So you're out again, right?
Yeah. Just a little one, just a little 10-dayer.
Right. Yeah, but we're playing Pompeii, which we're very much looking forward to.
You know,
to take Echoes back to Pompeii is going to be.
Oh, wow.
Really cool.
That's a buzz.
Yeah. Looking forward to that.
Well, he's saying, the fact of the matter is, everyone's doing fucking great and still doing what they want. And we all come from the same hazardous decadence.
Do you know what? It's been a real pleasure talking to you today because I've been really worried. I was really worried, as everyone else was, about you. And just bumping into you week before last or whenever it was and seeing that you're, hearing good news and hearing you today, completely amazing stories we've had from you today. I mean, I really feel this is a very special episode of our show. And,
I'm just so fucking lucky I'm here.
That was an extraordinarily moving.
That was a very powerful one.
Episode, yeah,
I would say.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's his honesty that is so disarming,
yeah.
It's because a lot of people try and keep that stuff hidden, because they don't want to mess up their work, their public persona, and to reveal.
Well, there's also a thing of you very much want your privacy at that time.
Well, there also is that as well, and people can't not everyone is the same. But I think what I'm trying to say is that. I think a lot of people who might be listening who are in similar situations, would gain a lot of strength out of that.
Definitely. That there's very often, a corner to turn.
And you're in it, this story, weren't you? You were in it quite a lot, this particular episode.
Oh, you didn't like it, did you?
It was a lot about you. Which I think is part of what we do. It's like we were there on the ground.
Well, Andy's been part of. Robert Palmer's very, very and Power Station, very important part of my life. It was actually really nice to be taken back there.
And talking about Robert, because he was, we owe him some stuff as well. He didn't just suddenly appear, and then kind of catch on to the 80s. I remember being, obviously he was in Vinegar Joe and he was in Vinegar Joe. That's right.
Vinegar Joe.
Elkie Brooks.
But Sneaking Sally through the alley. I mean, the first guy, this was an, English singer come out of a band and his first solo record. One side, the backing band is the Meters. The other side, the backing band is Little Feet. I mean, come on.
Such a great record and really inspired us. I know my brother and I had that on all the time and I often go back to it now, and especially that track, Sneaking Sally Through the Alley. The groove. Oh, my God.
Ah, that bass line as well. But when I worked, because the time when I met Robert, he just put out Pride, and I was completely obsessed with that album. I still think it's absolutely brilliant because it was post after, you know, because he got hip to Gary Numan and worked with him.
Yeah.
And he made this album, which was all totally electro, all electronic sounds, electronic drums, electronic everything. But every note was played. It was brilliant.
Well, everything that sounded like a sequencer was actually
played. Sounded like sequencers, machines. None of it was. Every single note played. Brilliant.
Amazing. All right, you can get more stuff from us by signing up on rockonteurs.com and get some extras, which get put out quite a bit.
Almost, they get put out, but not as much as Gary was, it seems.
I could try to contribute.
You had so much to contribute. Come on, what are you talking about? You
were the kidding, other I'm kidding. You know, kidding.
You were the other bloke. I know.
I was. Anyway, thanks for listening, and thank you to our producer Ian today from Gimme Sugar.
Yes, Ian today. Well
Ben,
done.
Ben's away, and it's good night from me.
And it's good night from them.
Rock On Tours is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.